Tonight we're going to be talking about a burst of conscious light, near-death experiences, the Shroud of Turin, and the limitless potential of humanity. Wow, what a topic and a subtitle there, Doctor.
Yes, well, of course, I do find it an interesting subject myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what's the genesis of this book that you wrote?
Well, you know, it all goes back to around 30-40 years ago, a film that I watched regarding an object known as the Shroud of Turin, and the film was called The Silent Witness. Mm-hmm. And what amazed me about it was that the image on this cloth, that the scientists who had studied it, they couldn't account for how such an image could have been formed by any manufacturing process, as it were, and the only explanation that they could come up with, which was consistent with the evidence, was that there had been a short, intense burst of radiant energy from the dead body of the man that the shroud wrapped. Now, this was a conclusion that was reached based on the scientific empirical evidence, and so what fascinated me was to try to understand how such a phenomenon could be possible, and how to understand this scientifically. And what I realized was that perhaps this is possible, but to do so, one would need to include an understanding of consciousness and how mind and matter might be related within science itself, rather than just seeing science as purely a materialist subject.
Mm-hmm. So you've sort of combined, just in the title alone, near-death experiences, and then you brought it into a positive light of saying that it indicates some sort of a limitless ability, potential for humanity, and this is all drawn from your research on the Shroud of Turin?
That was what initiated it, yes. But then as I looked into it further, and I looked into the question of what evidence there might be to understand consciousness as being more than just the property and result of a collection of atoms, then of course it's difficult to consider that subject without considering the near-death experiences, which have demonstrated to many researchers that in fact when the brain stops functioning, consciousness does not stop. So during cardiac arrest, when the brain waves are flat, the consciousness continues, and people are having experiences during that time where the brain is not functioning, and they're able to recall those experiences after being resuscitated, often including recalling events that they witnessed that they couldn't have known about physically. These are known as veridical near-death experiences, where, for example, people who were completely unconscious and whose hearts were not beating and whose brain waves were flat were able to listen to the voices of the people who are in the resuscitation room, and also able to see remotely things that were happening elsewhere during that time when their brain was not functioning. Mm-hmm. Which has provided evidence for many people that therefore the consciousness does not rely on the brain. And this of course ties in very strongly with evidence from quantum physics, which suggests that matter, the very existence of matter, is dependent on consciousness rather than the other way around, which led leading and founding researchers in quantum theory such as Erwin Schrödinger and Max Planck to go on the record over 80 years ago and saying that they believe that consciousness must be completely fundamental, that it cannot be a product of matter. And in fact there are some very eminent scientists in the modern day who have also gone on the record saying similar things, such as Andre Linde of Stanford University.
Mm. So you're saying then that consciousness is separate from the brain?
What I'm saying is that the brain does not make consciousness, just like your radio doesn't sing to you when you switch it on. It's not a product. The music you hear is not made by the radio, and your mind is not made by your brain.
Okay, so but it still it indicates to me that there are perhaps two Daniel Otts. One where my brain is, which has my emotions and my memories, but then there's another Daniel Ott of consciousness. Would that be a fair description?
Or are they the same? You see, when you say where your emotions and your memories are, what I'm suggesting is that your memories and your emotions don't have a location in the brain as such, that they interrelate with the physical universe through the brain, but that is not their location. We have this perception often that somehow our thoughts are happening inside our brain, which is in a sense an illusion, in the sense that we're used to our sensory information coming at us through our eyes and our ears and so on, which are centered in the head, but actually when you actually think about it, they don't actually have a location as such. And in fact, despite the many efforts by neuroscientists over the decades, it has not been possible to demonstrate that memory actually resides or is located in the brain, and that although there can be associations between emotions and signals in the brain, that those emotions are actually made by those signals in the brain. Just as the example I use in the book is that if you walk along the beach and you leave footprints there, those marks in the sand are not you. They're the results of your interaction with the beach. Just like your mind interacts with the brain, and that produces things that we can detect, for example, in functional magnetic resonance imaging and all the other things that look at activity that goes on in the brain. But that doesn't mean that you're located there or that the brain is actually making those things.
Is a person, Dr. Silverman, just the result of their memories?
No, you see. The important distinction that I always try to make is the distinction between the fact of your awareness and what you are aware of. So, you see, for example, if people believe that all they are is the sum of their memories, then if you write all your memories down in a book, in a diary, then that book contains your... Is that book then you? Of course it isn't, because the book is not conscious. So that simple thought experiment, if you like, proves that you cannot derive or summarize a conscious entity in terms of information, because we're not made of information. We're not a string of ones and zeros. We are, rather than being made of bits of information, we are that which can be aware of information. Mm-hmm. And you can't summarize that in terms of facts or numbers or data. Mm-hmm. So that's the distinction. You're not your memories, but you are that within which your memories can be perceived.
Mm-hmm. So if technology got to the point where they could download my entire memory history, every single bit from even perhaps when the sperm hits the egg and that spark of light, which happens, nobody seems to know where it comes from, happens, and took that, downloaded it, and then uploaded it into another sperm spark of light at that exact moment, would it reproduce me?
Exactly not, yes. But that's the point, that you cannot, if you just take a collection of facts or of data, that doesn't generate the one who can perceive that. Just like if you record if you write a diary or you record a diary of a video diary or whatever it is of information about you, that information is not you. It doesn't become you. It won't wake up one day and be you. I go through all the logical sequence of steps in the book to demonstrate that it is not possible to synthesize a conscious being in any way ever. Mm-hmm. That in fact consciousness, if it were synthesized, would have to have a beginning, and I make the case that actually it cannot have a beginning because it's beyond time. In fact, time itself is the product of consciousness. And this is something, again, that Erwin Schrödinger, the founder of quantum theory, alluded to, that there's nothing in the laws of physics that accounts for there being a present and now, or even of time itself. And the only reason why we can have a concept of time, the notion of a now and a present, is because of consciousness, and therefore consciousness is the creator of time, and as such can't be made by time or destroyed by time. It must be eternal. If it has no beginning, then it can't be synthesized.
Wow, that is some profound thinking there, Dr. Silverman. And for those of you just joining the broadcast, we have on our newsmaker line Dr. Silverman from the UK. Doctor, some say that we live in it. You mentioned quantum, that we live in a quantum universe. In that, they said that, now this is just somebody's theory that I heard not too long ago, that the everything is created that we see by a quantum computer, and that when you're in a room, that the computer hasn't formulated what's outside the door until you open the door, because it wants to save power and it has so much data. Have you ever heard of theories like that? It's sort of like Schrödinger's cat, that you know that things aren't really there until you see them.
Well, it is actually what is. It's not quite just a theory that it's not there until you see it. It's actually, this is demonstrated empirically through experiment, that with, for example, if people want to look up the double slit experiment, and there's an excellent book about this called Quantum Enigma, that goes through this in very simple details. But you see, the thing about the simulation is that what is not there until you perceive it is the facts, the data, the information. But what is there is the consciousness that can perceive it. So that's the point, that you can't be part of a simulation. You can't be part of a program of a computer, because if you were, that computer would just be a string of ones and zeros. And there's no... However long you make a string of ones and zeros, it will just be a string of ones and zeros. It will just be data, information. You can't make it wake up and be a sentient being. So that's the point, that the electron, the photon, or whatever quantum properties we're referring to can be demonstrated empirically not to be in a fixed state until they are detected or observed or measured. This is what's known as the measurement problem in quantum theory. Mm-hmm. But this doesn't apply to consciousness itself, which is actually the measurer. You see, it's not the measured. So that's the consciousness is a fundamental prerequisite for any of that atom, electron, photon, or whatever to be or not to be. Okay. So you are not a simulation, but yes, what you perceive, it becomes real through being able to be perceived.
Mm-hmm. Does every living thing have a conscience? Consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, I would suggest that is a part of life itself, that life and consciousness go together in varying degrees in a spectrum. You know, there would be I expect less conscious realization within like a bacterium or a worm than a human being, but that there is some still remnant of it within anything that lives.
And at what point does consciousness combine with the organic development of human? Is it always there? Is it at conception? Where is consciousness? When does it come in? Or is it always out there? Where is it?
Right. Well, you see, I would suggest that consciousness, in view of what I was saying about it not having a beginning, so your consciousness doesn't begin at conception, but that might be when your consciousness starts to interact with that collection of atoms that we call a human being, so that you begin to take on that identity at that location, so to speak. So that's not the beginning of you, but that's your beginning of interaction with that point in space and time that we call a body.
All right, we've the folks watching the show are sending in questions, Dr. Silverman. So let's go ahead and get a couple of questions coming in for you from Australian Ben out of the live chat. It says, Doctor, consciousness is the invisible ocean of the universe, so to speak.
Right. Is that a question or?
There's a question mark at the end of it. So let me rephrase that. Is consciousness the invisible ocean of the universe?
Right. Consciousness, I would say, is that which sees. So if we talk about what's visible and what's not visible, it is visible or not visible to consciousness. The problem with analogies, metaphors, or definitions is that we're always defining something in relation to something else. So, for example, if someone tells you what is the color blue, you could say, well, it looks like the sky or it looks like the sea. How do you describe the color blue to a blind person? How can you tell them what it looks like if they don't recall ever seeing anything that is blue? So the thing about consciousness, in a sense, because we are all conscious beings, we know what consciousness is because we are it. But as soon as you try to define it in terms that relate to things that are not conscious, like oceans or physical universes and so on, then you realize that you can't complete the circuit of describing what it is. You can never write it in machine code to so a computer can understand, if you like, what consciousness is. But because you are conscious, you are consciousness. You know what consciousness is. It is to be aware.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You mentioned water. Wasn't there a study that showed that water has memory?
Yes, again, what this is showing is that information can reside in water. So a cassette tape has memory. A CD has memory in the sense, if by memory you mean that something contains information. If a teacher writes on a board in a classroom, the board that they've written on has memory in as much as there is writing on it, but the board doesn't perceive what is written on it, but the students in the room looking at the board will perceive it. So in that sense, water itself may have information residing in it, perhaps, which can be read by consciousness, mm-hmm. which is not to say that the water is conscious or that anything is conscious. Just as I was saying with a radio, you turn your radio on and a song comes from the radio, but the radio isn't singing to you. So the radio may pick up this information, which we can then experience as a song that may have meaning to us, but there's no meaning to the radio as an object. It doesn't sing, it doesn't know what the song means, it doesn't feel the meaning of the song, but as a human being hearing it, you may well do.
Mm-hmm. In our background here, I got a screen grab from your book, and it appears to be the fibers of the Shroud of Turin, and it appears to have red blotches on there. Is that the blood?
I'm not off the top of my head. I'm not sure of the image you're seeing, but yes, there is blood on the Turin Shroud, which there are illustrations, as I recall, that demonstrate photomicrographs, they're called, which is high resolution, very magnified photos to show the difference between the bloodstains on the Turin Shroud and the body image areas. Mm-hmm. So yes, there is blood, and it has been chemically tested and shown to be human blood.
Mm-hmm. On the Shroud. Now, if it were to be re-liquefied, would we be able, or even in its present state, are they able to get DNA from it?
They may be able to get some of that, but not in the sense of the sort of science fiction notions of sufficient DNA to to clone a human being or anything like that, but there would be some DNA there. Of course, there will be DNA on the shroud from all the many thousands of people who have been in contact with it over mm-hmm. over these thousands of years as well. In addition to there being DNA in the blood on the blood stains.
I was just wondering if we both agree that water has a memory. I wonder if the dried blood could be reconstituted somehow and liquefied. Would it contain memory? But let's go to another question from one of our viewers. Curious says, Dr. Silverman, do thought waves exist that can be transmitted through space and time?
Right. Well, of course, you see, waves implies that, again, if you like, the way I describe it, I talk about stuff, if you like, meaning discernible things, matter, energy, space, and so on. My point is that thought itself is not of that. Thought is not. It has no mass. It has no electrical charge. It can't be defined in terms of any object. So. There may be information from thought that can move in waves, such as, you know, as we're having our conversation, our mm-hmm. words are producing waves in the air, and they're being transmitted electromagnetically across the internet, mm-hmm. and that's how we're communicating, and that's waves that are moving through space and time that are happening because of our thoughts, mm-hmm. But they're not our thoughts.
But
there are words.
But doctor, hasn't it been proven that thoughts and thought experiments, that thoughts have been able to, say, close doors or levitate an object? Wouldn't that mean that there is some force that can go with the power of thought?
Well, the power and force of course, two different things. But yes, what you're referring to is the power of mind over matter. This is something that people do look at from the point of view of parapsychology and looking at experiments to try and, you know, see whether such a thing exists. In fact, when I was a student around 30 years ago, there was a newly inaugurated professor of parapsychology in Scotland who came to do an inaugural lecture at my medical school, and he was talking about all the evidence at that stage about, you know, whether these things existed. And, you know, I just put my hand up at question time, and when they pointed to me to ask a question, I didn't actually have a question. I just wanted to make the point that in raising one's arm, you're demonstrating the power of mind over matter, because you decide to raise your arm, and that is what triggers the activity in the brain that causes the arm to move. So yes, there is a power of mind over matter, but that doesn't mean that mind is a material thing. In fact, to the contrary, because if your material force always follows a chain of cause and effect that is deterministic, it can be that can be predicted. But the point about free will, again, this is something a point that I make a lot in the book, is that free will is what I call primary causation, that nothing makes you have to make the choice that you made. There can be influences that make it more likely, but if there is such a thing as free will, and I argue in the book why I suggest that there is, then that proves that mind cannot be a product of force, because if it were, then your choices would all be fixed and determined in advance. So the very fact that you can influence matter in a way that you choose to do is actually a good demonstration that your choice is not a material phenomenon. It's beyond that.
Mm. And doctor, what time is it where you're at? About 2 a.m.?
That's right, yes.
My goodness. Well, I sure appreciate you staying up late for us, because you really have some thought-provoking information to share with us here in the United States. All right, let's get to another question for you. It says, doctor, is consciousness part of what's called the golden ratio?
Right. Again, golden ratios are talking about measurements of extent, if you like, a ratio of one number to another number, and the point about consciousness is that it's beyond number, if you like. It's like zero and infinity all combined. It can never be defined in terms of a discrete fixed amount of something, because it's not something. So if it were merely a ratio, then all you'd need to do to make a conscious machine is to design it within that ratio. But you could do so, and it would still be a machine, so it wouldn't be conscious. So I would say that consciousness is not a result of anything. That consciousness is primary. It's fundamental, and all else is a result of it rather than the other way around. You can't make it by any formula or ratio or magic spell or technology, that it cannot be made, but it doesn't need to be made because it's already there. You are it, and you are eternal and have no beginning.
All right. For those of you just joining the broadcast, we have all the way from the UK, Dr. Andrew Silverman. We're talking about his book, A Burst of Conscious Light, Near-Death Experiences, The Shroud of Turin, and The Limitless Potential of Humanity. You can drop a question in the live chat or send it on the link at the top of the website in the menu bar. It says guest question. Let's go to another question for you, Doctor. This says, do you believe that evil exists?
The thing about these value judgments is that one has to decide what one means by good and by evil, first of all, to understand it. But what I believe is that our state of existence in this physical universe is a result of us being less than we could be. So we've become separate and divided, and we've become restricted, and symptoms of that restriction are seen in things like selfishness, like things that divide consciousness, divide beings from each other, such as racism and all of selfishness and materialism, and that all of those things make us less than we could be. Whereas what all the great teachers, people like Jesus, the Buddha, and so on, were teaching about loving our neighbor as ourself, that's the antidote to that. That's how we could fulfill our true potential and become limitless. So if you like, what I would say is that those tendencies in thinking, thought, behavior, and action that tend to separate and divide and devalue humanity and sentient being, those things are the closest I could get to using a word like evil, and surely they do exist, as we see around us so often in the news and so on, all the terrible things that human beings can do to each other. But if we have free will, then it's not fixed that we have to be like that. We can be the other way. We can care. We can see deeper and wider and broader.
I know part of the subtitle of your book, Near Death Experiences. How does that fit in with the Shroud of Turin and consciousness?
Okay, well, good question. The thing is, of course, that the image on the shroud can be seen scientifically and empirically that happened after the bodily death of the man whom the shroud wrapped. And I go into in great detail in the book the implications of what it could mean that this happened after he had already physically died, but the consciousness hadn't ended. Now, in near-death experiences, the brain waves are flat. The person is effectively clinically dead during a near-death experience, and yet their consciousness is continuing. It's interesting to look at the evidence of what people perceive during these near-death experiences and the light that they perceive, which is a very common theme that so many people describe. And this is going back through the centuries before there were words like near-death experience and so on. The people who came close to death would perceive this light light in which they felt within that light was all knowledge and all compassion. They felt cared for by that light. This ties in, and again, it's without going through the book to in detail. It's difficult to go through all of it, but there is evidence that if you look at, for example, a dialogue with a famous physicist called Professor David Bohm, he was asked, why do you think light is used as a common metaphor in spiritual matters and so on? And this quantum physicist, David Bohm, was pointing out that actually light, or anything that moves at the speed of light, in a sense unifies different and distinct points in space and time, that according to Einstein's relativity, and this is not just a theory, this has been demonstrated and backed up by numerous experiments, that as you approach the speed of light, and if you are at the speed of light, that there is no space or time to you. Everywhere and everywhen, if you like, it is all one. From the point of view of light, the origin and destination are not separate in space, and no time elapses in getting from one to the other. And so it sort of implies that this physical universe of separation, which has arisen, as I said, the point that I make in the book, out of us being less than we could be, and therefore becoming separate, that separation makes space, and the light that people see in their death experiences, and the light which may also have formed the image on the shroud, stands testament to the opposite to that separation, to the oneness of all being.
Question came in. It says, if consciousness came before all things, isn't there actually only one consciousness?
Yes. Well, that's right. Consciousness is one fundamentally, and that is why that these great teachers would say, love your neighbor as yourself, because ultimately your neighbor is yourself. So fundamentally, it is all one, but mm-hmm. and yet at the same time, it is separate because we make it separate. So as long as we exist as individuals, then separation exists as well, because we are not all one, because we don't all love our neighbor as ourselves, and we make separation and materiality happen, and this whole physical universe in which suffering and all these terrible things happen that we were referring to, that we see on the news. That is because, yes, we can all be one, but at this moment in time, we're not.
Mm-hmm. When you say talk about loving your neighbor, which is, you know, a pillar of civilized society and the moorings and the glue that hold us together from becoming barbarians, is there a neighbor who, say, is a dope-smoking killer? Do we have the same love for him?
Well, yes. Loving doesn't mean condone any particular form of action that someone does. Love just means that you would want the best for someone, and you would do what you can to help them if you can. And helping someone doesn't always mean giving them what they want. You know, talking about civilized society, there's an interesting quote that Mahatma Gandhi was once asked in an interview, what's your opinion about Western civilization? And he thought for a moment, and he said, you know, I think that would be an excellent idea.
Okay, that's, well, the good doctor's got brought a one-liner to us tonight. That's great. Well, you know, the Indians say that life is like a web, and what you do to the web, you do to yourself. So, and what you're describing really right there, and it's a good answer, is unconditional love.
And, yes, indeed.
And so, you know, obviously with what's going on in the world, it seemed like it would be easy to gravitate toward more hate. And the thing, Doctor, I know, as humans, and it's going to, you talk about the selfishness of the human, the way the humans are, the selfishness we have, is that if we see, we sort of start justifying when we see actions of others. Well, we almost self-justify the hate or the angst. Hate is a very powerful word, but you know, we feel like we have a right, so to speak, to be angry and to hate the person. And really, it's something that we have to fight. It's almost as if we're not equipped to reach that level of forgiveness, unconditional forgiveness, without the help of, say, you mentioned Mahatma Gandhi and you mentioned Jesus. It seems as if humans need help externally, maybe in the form of written words such as the Bible, or a spiritual influence such as, say, what somebody would say is the Holy Spirit or angels, some external help. Do we have the ability? Are we born with unconditional forgiveness, or do we need these external helps?
Well, I think the external help is there if we choose to use it. Of course, these people that we're referring to were themselves human beings, so they demonstrate. Then this is a point I make in the book, and this is actually a point that if you look at what people like Buddha and Jesus taught, that they are actually teaching that everything that they were doing and saying, that all other human beings were capable of being the same. In fact, I think someone told me it was John chapter 14 that Jesus is reported to have said that all the things that people saw him do, that he said, you can do these things also, and greater than these things can you do. That if you have faith the size of a mustard seed and you say to the mountain, move, it will. So all of these points that they were making, and the Buddha said, don't believe anything that I say just because I've said it. Go and look at it yourself, and decide for yourself if I'm right. But they were always promoting each human being to fulfill their own potential, not to see themselves as useless and only being able to function out of what somebody else does, but to realize that you can be that, in following their example, you can be an example as well.
Mm-hmm. The man is on the shroud, or impregnated into the shroud fibers, as I think might be appropriate. Does it seem that there was you put a burst of conscious light. Are you saying it was light, the being that was under the shroud, burst into light and impregnated into the fibers, a 3D representation of what was quite obviously a man?
Yeah, well, I'm not saying that the shroud contains him as such. What I'm saying is that an event happened in that tomb 2,000 years ago, whereby that something happened with that body that caused a burst of light to come from that body, and the image, if you like, is in a sense simply a residue of that effect that happened, such that we now have physical scientific evidence that this event occurred.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get to another question for you. Did the shroud capture the essence of consciousness, much like a photograph captures a ghost?
Right. Again, I think this is what we were referring to just before, that what is that in that image is not his consciousness any more than if someone takes a photograph of you that you are on that camera film. On the subject of one-liner jokes, this reminds me of a little quote from a film from the 1980s called Crocodile Dundee, where this lady, she's a reporter, and she's talking to this chap who's an Australian Aborigine, and she's going to take a photograph of him, and he said, I'm sorry, mate, you can't take my photo. And she said, oh yes, I'm sorry, I forgot, you believe that the camera will steal your soul. And he said, no, mate, it's because you've got your lens cap on. Yeah, the camera, an image of you is not you. It doesn't contain your essence, your being, your soul, your spirit. It's just an image. Mm-hmm. So my point about the image on the shroud is not that this object contains, that the piece of cloth contains Jesus of Nazareth, but it does have a photographic or something like a photographic imprint of his body, which occurred due to an event that happened in that tomb. And I believe that that event is a great clue to us about the very nature and potential of humanity itself, not just that individual human being, mm-hmm. but what it says about all of us in our fullest nature and potential.
In your book, do you have stories of near-death experiences?
Yeah, I don't go into individual stories in detail, although there are several wonderful books that do that in more explicit detail, such as the couple of the very good researchers on near-death experiences who kindly posted, you know, positive comments that are on the sleeve of my book, Dr. Pim van Lommel and Dr. Eben Alexander. They have published sort of detailed accounts of specific near-death experiences. What I've done in the book is to say, to sort of summarize certain key features of those experiences that tell us more, to help us to understand what we are as human beings, and to prove to us that we don't end when we die, that our mind is not made by our brain.
You mentioned free will in the first hour, and
yes,
and you believe that we are free will beings and we have a choice. But if you are born, say in Africa, into some poor village, and locusts are eating the crops, and you're starving, that person and those people did not have a choice, and many of them will die. But that's not a choice they made. So how do we square that with free will or
sure.
versus destination?
Right. Now, you see, there's a distinction between, and again, this is in the book, a distinction between freedom of choice and freedom of choices. So, you know, it's just like you may want to have a Ferrari, and you may wish it, and you look outside your window and it's not there. So does that mean you don't have free will because you don't have what you want? Now, of course, it's a far more extreme version for someone who's starving, but you know, that they're not having food because they want it. But my point about free choice is that it's not about that it's not doesn't necessarily mean you can have whatever you want to have. It means that within the realms within which you can make choices, those choices that you make are free.
Mm-hmm.
So someone who is in a situation where there's a you know, shortage of crops and so on, that means that there are certain choices that are not open to them, that they aren't there for them to make, but within the range of options that are there for them, they can choose freely within those. And if you can make any free choice between any options, then that is free choice. Even if you're locked in a prison cell, you can't go anywhere, but in your mind you're free to consider different memories from the past and think about them as you choose to do. You're still making free choices within that, even though there are some options that you can't access.
Okay, well, that's a good explanation there. And I did understand that. The near-death experiences, have you talked to anyone who's had one?
Yes, I have.
Are there similarities?
You know, I have had patients who have related them to me.
Okay, what type of doctor are you?
I'm a medical doctor, so I am now qualified in as a, I think you call it over there, you call it family physician. We call it general practitioner in the UK. But I've also, during the course of my career, I have worked in hospitals and also in hospices. And so it's quite in what we call accident and emergency departments. So you call them emergency rooms, I think. So I've got quite a broad range of medical experience, really.
By the way, just kind of an aside here, you guys have universal health care over there?
We do, yes. We have what we call a national health service, which means that health care is free for... no charge for healthcare for anyone.
And so, if somebody needs, a tonsillectomy, what's the waiting time?
For that particular example, because a lot of the time tonsillectomy is not considered to be as helpful as it used to be. So maybe that's not a very good example.
Okay, but when there's
something urgent that's needed, say for example, cancer surgery and so on, then that can be that is made available within weeks rather than months or years. So, or if someone has appendicitis, then there's no waiting time. If they need the operation, they have it.
Okay, all right. So, in the course of your practices, have you seen people near death? Or they have died and came back. What story did they say? What did they see?
Right. My research in near-death experiences hasn't really been deep questioning of the people. And in fact, in the time that was related to me being very busy working in a busy hospital unit, there wasn't really that much time to talk to each patient. It's very much like firefighting, you're on to the next emergency, sort of thing. I haven't really drawn on anecdotal reports from my own experience that have been reported to me, but there are plenty in the literature, including a very broad study that was done by cardiologist Dr. Pim van Lommel on many, many different patients who had near-death experiences, and I tend to refer to sort of more sort of scientific data like that rather than my own first-hand reports that have been related to me, which have not been very great in detail.
Well, I'm trying to find the connection between the subtitle of your book, as if there's a connection. I know I've asked you this, but the connection between near-death experiences and the shroud. You're saying that the shroud proves life after death, or that consciousness continues after death.
Yeah, near-death experiences prove that consciousness is not made by the brain, and therefore that the brain stopping doesn't stop consciousness, which therefore must continue. Now, the shroud. See that there's a few chapters on that in the book, so difficult to summarize it fully in a soundbite. But that is showing. Not just that that the consciousness of the man on the shroud was persisting. It's telling us about what that consciousness achieved, if you like, how a human being through living according to the principles that he had taught and lived according to, how even the very atoms of his body were able to change, such that Professor David Bohm pointed out that matter is actually frozen light, and something happened, if you like, in that tomb that began to unfreeze the matter so that the light shone, and that happened after his body had died, and we know that his body had died, because the bloodstains and the body image are separate phenomena from each other. Mm-hmm. And we can tell from the bloodstains that he was dead when he was wrapped in the shroud, and we can also see from the fact that there's no image underneath the bloodstains that the burst of light happened after the bloodstain, so therefore after he had died.
Mm-hmm. What's your best guess of what happened in that tomb?
Right. Well, now as you look at, there's two different events. One is the formation of the bloodstains, which is a simple physical process, that a dead body was wrapped in the cloth, and that there were clots of blood that were still damp, and some of that the clot and serum was transferred to the cloth to form the stain. So that's the easy one. Okay, and that was at the time that happened, the body was flat, supine on his back, and so on. Now there's a second thing, when the actual image formed, and now I'm relating to work that has been done by a physician from Boston in the US called Dr. Gilbert Lavoie, and I'm citing him on this because I only became aware of this through actually listening to a paper that he presented, which was quite a revelation to me, because and once you see it, then it makes so much sense. But I had to admit, I didn't see it until I heard it from him. And that is that when you look at the body image on the shroud, if the body had been flat when the image formed, you would expect to see flattening on the back of the body, for example, at the calves and the buttocks, and you would expect that the hair would be hanging down behind him. That's not what you see. What you see is that the tissues at the back of the body are rounded, and that the hair is down on his shoulders. So it looks as though when the image formed, that the body was actually upright and vertical. So you might think, oh, the body was standing, but no, it wasn't, because the feet are not aligned in a standing position. It looks as though, and this is just based on the physical empirical evidence on the shroud image, that the body was actually upright and suspended above the ground. Now, this is fascinating because two things that we're seeing here, again, through scientific empirical studies of the shroud image, is that the body had risen up above the ground, was suspended in the air, and that there was a burst of light that came from the body. Now, these things would not have been apparent to people in the 19th century, and definitely not in medieval times, but that it's only because we've used our 20th and 21st century technology to study the image, and now we've found these things which fascinatingly point to show us two things that are recorded anecdotally as having happened as well during the lifetime of this individual. For example, you know, when he was seen to walk on the water, and at one point to rise up above the ground, and when people looked at him and they saw a brightness like the sun, it's described, coming from him. So I think what we're actually seeing there is the undoing of the, we were talking earlier at the start of the interview about the physical universe and our subtraction in a separate state, being separate, divided from each other through selfishness and all the things that divide man from each other, such as racism, selfishness, materialism, nationalism, and all of these things. Well, he was showing an antidote to those negative types of emotion and thoughts and action. And it looks as though he actually lived that to such an extent, that antidote, that he actually was able to undo that enforcement of matter that freezes light as matter, such that force began to become less in his environment, so that his body was light enough to be able to float, and that the atoms actually began to shine as the twist, if you like, that kept them material was beginning to become undone. And therefore, I believe that he was demonstrating the full potential of what all human beings are capable of by being an example of that himself.
Mm-hmm. It's been said that when someone dies, their body weight decreases by 23 grams. Is that the consciousness or the spirit leaving the body?
I think it has been said that that happens, but I don't think anyone has ever actually measured such a phenomenon. And I would say that consciousness has no mass. Mm-hmm. That's what we were saying again at the start, that I'm trying to make a distinction here between stuff, if you like, substance, mm-hmm. and consciousness. You can't weigh a mind. You can't measure it in terms of inches and feet and yards or whatever.
I understand that. Is the soul the same as consciousness?
I don't really use the word soul in the book because it has certain connotations that imply to some people that a soul is something that is like a little parcel that's made presumably by some form of creator God that forms you and puts you into existence. But my point is that that would imply, if that were true, that would mean that you have a beginning. And I would argue that the point about consciousness is that it has no beginning, that you're not a parcel of consciousness that is made. But if you want to define what we each are as individuals, then I would say that if you consider that light that people perceive in near-death experiences, that is all knowledge and all compassion, then we are the pattern of shadows that makes us mm-hmm. less than that light, mm-hmm. and that each of us has our own individual pattern of restriction. Perhaps someone like the man of the shroud showed what happens when a human being sort of completely divests mm-hmm. themselves of all that shadow and they become purely the light, and then you don't need a body anymore once you reach that state.
If here's what I thought I heard you say, that if we believe we have a soul, if man believes he has a soul, that portends then that there must be a soul provider, as in a God. So are you saying that is why you don't like to use the word soul, because it would suggest there is a God?
No, I don't. You see, again, you see, this is going into how we use words, because I don't. What people describe as God, if you like, the ultimate of all being, I don't see as being something that creates or makes or acts in temporal ways within time. It would have to be timeless. So I'm not saying that there isn't a God. I'm saying that God is not, I don't believe, would not relate, would not be a phenomenon that like an old man in the sky that points finger and mm-hmm. creates you or makes your consciousness happen, that your consciousness referring to Jesus of Nazareth as we were, there's a point in the Bible where people are sort of criticizing him for referring to human beings and God in the same breath as a sort of implying that this could be blasphemous, and said, is it not written in the law, you are gods and children mm-hmm. of the Most High, which is just mm-hmm. quoting from the Old Testament mm-hmm. to them. And so what my point is that we have made ourselves less than God, if you like, that we mm-hmm. From the point of view of a physical universe of separation, that light that people see in the near-death experience is the closest thing that we can perceive mm-hmm. to what people call God. It's not itself God, but it's what God looks like from where we are, if you like. We are less than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I've heard that description of God, similar to what you just said, as an old man in the sky with a finger, to me, that is sort of a denigration of I think we could assume there is a God. A denigration of who he is, and reducing him to sort of a cartoon character,
yes,
to eliminate any possibility that he exists and that there's a responsibility in our end as humans as a result of his existence, but reducing him to a cartoon figure is used in many cases, to sort of say that if you think there is a God, then you believe in fairy tales. So yeah. why did you use those terms?
Right. No, because what I'm saying is that if you see God as an actor within, as one who acts and is temporal, a temporal being that creates in that sense, then that is implying that it's making him specific. Do you see what I mean? So I'm not saying that God is that, but I'm saying mm-hmm. that to consider God in specific temporal terms is making him that. Not that I'm making, that I'm suggesting that he actually is mm-hmm. that. I'm suggesting that he is not that, if mm-hmm. you like.
Well, I would suggest, and you mentioned actually in the first hour, you talked about the necessity of something that would have to be outside of time that yeah. always existed. That would describe who God really would be. I think time is exactly. a construct on our physical plane. But where does consciousness go when you die?
Right. Well, first of all, we have to consider where consciousness is before we die. Because as I was pointing out, our consciousness is related to our physical bodies and our brains, but it's not a thing that is located somewhere. If you explore through the nerve cells of your brain, you won't find a little bit then say, ah, here's your consciousness. So it where we are is more is not so much a question of location in space. Where we are is defined, if you like, more in as much as who we are. So you know, how you feel and the summary of your life in terms of what you have done that is kind, or what you have done that is harmful mm-hmm. to others defines where you are or and who you are. So mm-hmm. in near-death experiences, people often have a what they call a life review, mm-hmm. Where they see their life flashing before them very quickly, and although it seems to take, you know, a lot of time from within their perspective, mm-hmm. But they experience it always from the other person's perspective. So where mm-hmm. they have been unkind to someone, they feel what that felt like to that person, and, okay. and where they have helped okay. another person, okay. they feel the benefit of that help. And so I would say that where we are when we die is the summary of how we relate to each other and what we have done for or against
okay.
each other.
Okay, for this old cowboy here in the United States, I may have missed it, but where does consciousness go when we die?
Yeah, it's not a place. It's not in a place when you die, just as it's not in a place now. Mm-hmm. Location doesn't contain consciousness in a particular place that you can give coordinates to and say 5 miles north and 2 miles west, mm-hmm. because it doesn't. It's location exists because of consciousness, but consciousness doesn't exist within location. And if you mean how do we continue, then it may well be that if we have not been able to achieve the state of that light that I was referring to, that the man of the shroud may have achieved, mm-hmm. then we may actually come back again. I believe that mm-hmm. that something like reincarnation may actually be true, and there is plenty of evidence mm-hmm. that it is.
Mm-hmm. Is there any other religious item or relic like the shroud, say, for Buddha or Muhammad?
Yeah. First of all, I would say that I don't see the shroud as being a religious relic. I see it as a piece of scientific evidence as such. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of anything similar related to those two people that you mentioned. No.
Okay. Do you believe that we? And I think you sort of did. But do you think we're in a holographic universe?
Well, I think we're in a universe that is the product of of consciousness, that we're in it, that rather than of a hologram, that it's consciousness, that we have made separation happen through becoming distinct from each other, and that is what space and time, that's the source of where space and time mm-hmm. come from. Space, mm-hmm. time, and matter are actually the result of us becoming less than that light mm-hmm. that people experience in NDEs.
Like, Doctor, it seems like the world could use a whole lot more light and love. Mm. And it doesn't appear that it's heading in that direction. Will mankind ever see a sort of rebirth to where the divisions that divide humans and the emotions that contain the hate, envy, and greed and things like that, is that ever going to be solved?
Well, I think that's up to each of us. So I mean, we're quoting these great teachers. I mentioned Gandhi earlier, and he said, you know, be the change that you want to see in the world. So in as much as we take a stand against separation and division, you know, great people like Dr. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King and others who have made a stand for mm-hmm. for the oneness of all humanity. Mm-hmm. So if we can follow their example and see all human beings as equal and care for everyone just as much, and see that our humanity unites us all, then it's up to us to make it happen. Mm-hmm. Each of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can artificial intelligence reveal more secrets about the Shroud?
I don't think so, really. I think natural intelligence might do. In fact, it's interesting you mentioned artificial intelligence, because one of the key points that I make in the book is an argument how artificial intelligence will never, if you think about it, artificial intelligence will never be truly intelligent, because to be intelligent you have to understand, and to understand you have to be aware, and mm-hmm. A machine or a computer is never actually aware of anything. All it's actually doing is just processing information, just like a pocket calculator or an abacus processes information, mm-hmm. and it doesn't actually experience that information that it's processing. So that's why in the book I point to the dangers, and I'm not just the only one saying this. There have been some great teams of learned scientists, including Professor Stephen Hawking and others in universities of Oxford and Cambridge in England, who have been looking at what may pose the greatest existential threats to the existence of mankind, mm-hmm. What may be the most likely things to cause our extinction. And one of the things that they came to in the consensus is that one of the most likely parts of that could lead to our downfall is unanticipated consequences of technology. For example, if you you make us everything gets more mechanized, and you start to have more robots, and what you call it was get called artificial intelligence, whether or not it actually is intelligent in the strict sort of semantic sense I was referring to. Then, if these things are programmed to make sure that there's no human suffering, to a machine, the most efficient way of stopping human suffering is to wipe out all human beings, because if they're right. not there, they can't suffer. And a machine can't understand how that's wrong. The other thing is, of course, that through the obscuration of the understanding of consciousness being more than just information, more than just ones and zeros, more than just data, people can subscribe to what I believe to be a very foolish notion that you can upload your mind into a machine, which you never can, because it's what you put in the machine as data mm-hmm. downloaded from your brain or whatever mm-hmm. is never you. It's just mm-hmm. information. But if people believe that it's you, then they will think that they're mm-hmm. going to continue in that machine. So yeah. the body then can be destroyed, mm-hmm. and actually, they're no longer there. They're just left with the machine. In fact, people like Stephen Hawking and also Professor Martin Rees, when they're asked about, you know, if we were to have contact with extraterrestrial civilizations, they point out that it's likely that if we did receive anything from any other planet, it's far more likely that what would be coming here would not be anything living, but would just be machines, because once we start to develop advanced technology, the lifetime of what they call biological intelligence is very short, because it very quickly gets supplanted and replaced by machines and by what people call artificial intelligence. So the book is standing by the principle of stating how great all humanity is, and why a human being is far more than a machine, and why your consciousness cannot be created and cannot be manufactured, but is eternal and has no beginning or end.
Mm. Now, it's interesting. There is a scripture in the Bible that says, before you were born, God knew you as if the person existed before time as well. We have a copy, a screenshot of your book's title there, right now being displayed, and it of course says a burst of conscious light. Now we've been talking about consciousness, what it is, and as you just said, it appears to be beyond time and space itself. But when you say conscious light, to me that says that the light that was shown had a conscious.
Sure. No, that's a good point, and in fact, the title wasn't my idea. That was the publisher's. their idea. That wasn't the title I originally went with. That's quite a perceptive point you make. Yes, strictly speaking, the light itself is not conscious, and I can't disagree with you on that. But the light is there as a result of the consciousness. Just as I was saying that, you know, if you sing a song that has great meaning to people, the vibrations in the air are not your sentiment, are not your feeling. They're just movements in the air. It's just in that same way, the light itself is not you. But the light is a consequence of you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think another place the Bible says that God is light, and in Him is no darkness at all. So it seems to me that pure light is also a representation of pure love.
Yes. So that's what people, independently, people who don't know about the Bible in their near-death experiences, that's what they many of them perceive this directly without reading it in a book. That light that they perceive in the NDE, all knowledge and all love is there within that light.
Mm. So, who do you think Jesus actually was?
In terms of who he was, of course, I think who he was Jesus of Nazareth. What he was a human being, and a human being who demonstrated the full potential of what all human beings can be, and that's why his example is so precious, because I think he demonstrated how we could get it right.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever, I know this is a highly personal question, but have you ever just like in your quiet time just said, okay, I'm going to find out if there's a Jesus and just start talking to him and ask him, you know, who are you? Or show yourself to me. Have you ever done anything like that?
No, but then again, if you look at what he said to the people who cared about him, there's that dialogue with him and Peter, and he said, Peter, do you love me? Of course I do. He said, feed my sheep. He said, anything that you do to anyone, you do to me. So in that sense, he was standing testament to the oneness of all human beings, rather than being a point of focus for me on my own individually. Mm-hmm. That if I want to understand him properly, then I have to see him in everyone, I believe, rather than as some sort of meditative stance of imagining a personal relationship between me and him outside of other people. Mm-hmm. That if I want to be kind to him, I need to be kind to my fellow man, all of them.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like then if you have in projecting love from your heart, and I guess that's another matter. Talk about the heart. We talk about the soul. Talk about consciousness. I don't know if we have time to talk about the heart. But if do you feel then that if you exude love, present love to others, that you are that you have entered in, you that would be a relationship with Jesus Christ?
Yes, that if anyone does that, it would be. Well, that's what he himself said. And the, if you have done this for, you know, the poor man in the street, or the given food to the starving, you've given that food to me. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. But but that's what anyone would say who, not just him, anyone who cares for everyone would feel that anything that is done for anyone is done for them. So that's the plurality of being for everyone, and the unity of everyone being one in that sense of compassion.
Mm-hmm. And as far as everybody being one, there is continuing in the Bible toward the end. It talks about a separation between what's called the chaff and the wheat, indicating that the earth has a certain amount that are not considered, or I would know, maybe evil, or maybe not have the light in them, or a good conscience in them. Doesn't that indicate there's sort of a separation there?
Well, I mean, there is a sort of separation here implicitly already that we have made, in the sense that we are all less than that light, and in near death experiences there are people who have experiences of this light. Some people do actually experience a darkness and see. Suffering and so on, but often when they're resuscitated and they realize what they saw was relating to an aspect of their own personality and nature, mm-hmm. that actually they make changes afterwards. So what people tend to experience in the NDEs is not that they're being judged, but that their conscience, they are in a sense judging themselves and finding a way to see whether they can put right what they had done wrong, and maybe you know, sometimes if there is such a thing as reincarnation, that's you know, why we're drawn to come back, is because our conscience is giving us the opportunity to put it right. Whether we do put it right or not is of course another matter.
Mm-hmm. Or that right there is another scripture, actually. It says if you judge yourself, you should not be judged, and I say, Dr. Andrew Silverman, that, you know, we have to work on never having to, I guess the euphemism, never have to say you're sorry, really means is not allow hate to rise up in your heart and to do things that are negative towards other people. If you never, if you intentionally don't do that, then you'll never have to sort of correct it. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I mean, definitely. First rule is do no harm. That's also the Buddha taught that as well, yeah.
The old Buddha man. Hey, by the way, I don't think the Buddha rose from the dead. The message of the conscious light and near-death experiences and the, like as you say, the limitless potential of humanity, seems like a lot of people need that message. You know, that there is a, and you're not saying life after death. I think you're saying consciousness resides after death. But there seems to be a large amount of people that need to hear some sort of message that they're not getting.
Right. When you say they're not getting the message, do you mean they're not getting a message in the book, or do you mean they're not?
No, I mean, humans in general, worldwide. I related earlier when I said it didn't look like we're heading in a love ending here. It looks like something much different ending's going to happen.
Yes. Again, that's up to each of us as human beings to do whatever. If we believe in a principle of caring and compassion, then we have to be that principle, and it's not a fait accompli. We constitute the world between us as human beings. So it's up to what each of us do and how we all live.
Would you consider anything that you've said tonight, as maybe somebody else would be hearing it, would you consider any of that what they call New Age?
No, not really, because I think it's actually very old. What I'm saying, it's not actually it's not new. So it's not about. I'm not talking about pendulums and dowsing and crystals and all of this sort of thing. I am talking about what I believe is rational argument based on cogent evidence that can be considered by each person individually for themselves, and if there is a flaw in it, then if anyone can point that out, then I would be ready to change my mind. But so far, when I've put these ideas, you know, even the ideas about quantum physics to very eminent scientists, nobody has pointed out any flaw in them to me.
The idea of a conscience is it seems that some people that we would consider evil seem to not have. They would say that, you know, the act they did was they didn't have a conscience. They committed it in such a way.
Didn't have a conscience, did you say, or consciousness?
Well, yeah, I guess that's right. That's good correction there. It is a conscience.
Yeah.
About the right of good and evil. But there's a whole segment of society that is moving away from the view that there is a God that exists. And as they move away, it's being filled back in with the most bizarre evil tenets and the most debased ideas that could possibly come. And animals, and you said it earlier, talking about, you know, humans are particularly good at being evil to one another. But I would postulate that it's the idea when the rejection of an eternal being begins to take hold, then something comes in and fills that, and as you look across history, what fills that is pure ugliness and evil. It just is.
Well, what I would say is that you are eternal being, and what happens is that people are losing sight of the eternality of their being, and they is identifying human beings as being just lumps of flesh that sort of chance coming together of cells and atoms. I mean, having said that, you know, there are some people who don't have any would claim not to have any belief in eternality and so on, who can still be kind people. So if you want to compare this to the sort of you know, biblical sayings and so on, it's the one who said he wouldn't do his father's will but actually did it. What matters is, in a sense, not what people say they believe, but what their actions demonstrate, in as much as how much they either can care for others or are restricted to themselves. Because many people who would claim to be, you know, highly religious and believe in God can still commit terrible atrocities, and that's not God's fault. That's their own stupidity to do that. But so I think it's really about understanding the value of each and every human being.
You've mentioned a number of parables and scriptures in the Christian Bible there without sort of using religious euphemisms. But in some way, in respect, do you think you've made or making a scientific or intelligent case that many of its tenets are true and stand the test of time?
Yes, it's not just the what you've referred to as the Christian Bible. A lot of a lot of these things are shared between many, or if not all religions. But I don't see God as being religious. If you see what I mean, religion is the how mankind sort of how we sort of depict God in that, how we can perceive him or it, and often a lot of it is determined by cultural, historical, political, and so on, and so on factors. So that's why I don't see it as a theological matter. I see it as a rational one. Having said that, many of the things that people like Jesus taught can be demonstrated to be rationally very, very sensible things. I mean, in fact, even to the extent that some of what he referred to has relates to subsequent scientific discoveries, like he spoke about this world being one of, you know, moths and rust and thieves where everything breaks down. You know, that was 1900 years before the second law of thermodynamics was discovered, where it was found that the one most consistent thing in this physical universe is that everything breaks down. Everything goes from order into disorder. What I'm saying is that what he taught can actually be considered from a point of view of reason and sense, and it does make sense.
Mm-hmm. I think it was referred to Jesus as saying that if you can't love your brother who you can see, how can you love your father who you cannot see? Or another one would be God is love. And another one says God is light and in him's no darkness at all. And he that dwells in love dwells in the light. Give me something on that order from Buddha.
Right. He basically... I haven't got a set of quotes to give you, but he basically taught about the compassion and wisdom being that the heart of the full potential of consciousness, and that we have become deluded in restriction and limit, and that the way out of that is through compassion and wisdom, as I said. But I think it's not what matters. It's not so much who said whatever, but what makes sense and what doesn't. And I don't think you're going to go wrong if you want to base it on what you believe on what Jesus taught, because what he taught did make sense, and he sort of put his life where his words were. Of yeah. course, there is the question of finding what he did say, because of course, to some extent, things may have been sort of changed or altered for historical reasons over time.
Well, whenever I think of the Buddha, I always think now there's a guy who's got to lay off the ho-hos. All right, Dr. Silverman, we got near the end of the broadcast. I got your book in the background. Anything else you'd like to say as we wrap this conversation up?
Well, if people would like to learn more about what's written in the book or how to get the book, if they go to the website, it's andrewsilverman.co.uk.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Dr. Silverman, I appreciate you coming on the Ed broadcast. Can we have you on again sometime?
Oh, certainly. That would be very kind of you. Thank you.
Okay. Hey, man, and keep looking into that Bible. I got a feeling that we were talking about a personal relationship with Jesus. You just might experience it.